Please tell me about Neil Miller.
I have to start it out by saying that everybody sees what they see now because we're standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's how we get such a good view of our current future, because our past had giants in it. And Neil Miller was just such a giant. You know, in the mid-30s, he started with psychoanalysis, which was, you know, a big deal then. Actually went to Vienna and hung out with Freud and his students. And although he had some direct psychoanalytic sessions with some of Freud's favorite students, he turned down a session with Freud because Freud wanted $20, which with inflation nowadays is the equivalent of a $400 session. And he just thought that was a little too much. Interestingly, Freud actually wrote a letter and apologized, saying that he had to support his family and the fees were required and all of that. But, you know, it was just too dear to spend that kind of money. And that's one thing that Neil Miller actually kind of kicked himself a little bit for, because he thought that was, you know, it probably would have been worth the investment of that. But, you know, he was an experimentalist, and he tried to do a linking between behaviorism and psychoanalysis, and actually did quite a bit of solid work in that area. In the late 40s, early 50s, obviously Pavlov had come out with his classical conditioning. Now, Neil Miller thought that Pavlov's inhibition was somewhat like repression. And so he started to try and integrate in a kind of a generalized model, psychoanalytic principles and behavioral principles. And in the 1950s, he actually read a book that was translated from the Russian about the brain and all the body signals that could be classically conditioned. And he put together the fact that instrumental conditioning or operant conditioning and classical conditioning were somewhat related. They weren't obviously the same thing by any means. I mean, you didn't ring a bell and get the dog to salivate. You had to actually train the dog operantly to perform. And he went on to try to operantly condition autonomic responses, because the autonomic nervous system, not the voluntary nervous system, but the involuntary autonomic nervous system, the self-naming autonomic system. So he could show that you could control your blood pressure. And, you know, I mean, how the hell do you control your blood pressure? Well, you know, it's a subtle internal thing. You can't explain it. If we could explain how to control your blood pressure with words, talk therapy would work, you know? So what we basically find is that there were people that denied that this was actually possible. And they challenged his work. And they said, well, you know, I think that the blood pressure is being controlled by some subtle muscle control, and they're twitching or tensing or some kind of a voluntary, involuntary interaction. And how do you prove that that's not the case? Well, he started out by using Karari, which is a paralytic. You can find people that use a blowgun and hit you with a dart with Karari, and you're paralyzed. And you can hunt that way. I mean, it's probably easier using ballistics, but at the same time, you know, blowgun does work, you know. And they would paralyze little, you know, rats and have them control their blood pressure. And the difficulty was that across time, that experiment started to not work so well. The same experimental setup with the same things and everything, and it just didn't work out. And there were people that were accusing him of fraud and all sorts of stuff like that. But it wasn't, there was something going on. They could not figure it out. Now, the grad student at the time, Leo DeCara, was instrumental in all of this. And he was going through some divorce or something at the time. And they didn't know whether it was the Karari formula that was changing or if it was an experimenter effect. And they were starting to actually look at the experimenter effect as an issue. But they then found, you know, there are humans that are paralyzed, gunshot victims, spinal cord injuries where they have no control. They're totally paralyzed, neck down, and they could teach them control over their blood pressure. Now, it was about that time that Neil Miller started to interact with a biofeedback group. He was the founder of biofeedback and a foundational figure, obviously, that the one who did operant conditioning of classically conditioned responses and showed that the operant conditioning or instrumental learning was in fact effective. So we owe him, we're standing on his shoulders. He's the one who did all the groundwork and took all the guff. I mean, when you're doing groundbreaking work, there's a lot of people who claim that you didn't break the ground. So he's the one that plowed the fields and planted our current crop that we're harvesting. So it's really wonderful to look back and realize him. Now, he loves students. And if you go online, you'll see all sorts of good stuff about every one of his students. And his students were in and of themselves also famous. But he thought that students were our future. And in the Biofeedback Research Society, which he was a president of, Biofeedback Research Society started in the late 60s. It changed to the Biofeedback Society of America, then it changed to AAPB. So it's been around for a long, long time. And he was one of the original presidents of it. I remember him as the bald-headed professor from Yale that did blood pressure and heart and autonomic research. And he always had a cluster of people around him at all of these meetings. Now, I wasn't so much into blood pressure and that sort of thing. I did some temperature training with migraine and muscle rehab work and EEG work, but blood pressure wasn't really my thing. We did a little bit of work with gastrointestinal motility, but what we basically had was he had the biofeedback end of things. Now, neurofeedback didn't exist as a term. It was still EEG biofeedback,